Hello, greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Quantum Conversations, aka QC, where we like to talk about all kinds of topics, things that interest, engage, amuse, perplex, and yes, occasionally even vex us. Our approach here is to look at things through different lenses and angles and to unpick or unpack a topic and, whenever it lends itself, consider what might be overlooked, not taken into account, conveniently omitted, or intentionally redacted. But let's begin with a round of intros. My name is Nyusha, QC's originator, host, scribe, and researcher. And joining me is my chill yet effervescent co-host and the contributor of our lovely theme music, Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Nyusha. How's it going today?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Did you like the effervescent bit, Paul?
Effervescent, yes. I'm sparkling.
You are. You're sparkling.
Thank you for the always kind introduction.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. So on today's episode, I wanted to extend on our previous episode about sleep and take a deeper look at this fascinating and forgotten history of our ancestors' biphasic sleep patterns, why it is worth knowing about, and could these long-lost habits somehow be introduced in our modern age? We'll also consider how the late 19th century, 20th century proposal to switch our clocks back and forth twice a year has turned into one of the longest failed experiments, which frustrates us to no end and is still somehow active in many parts of the world. Why, Paul? Why?
These are questions we're going to have to ask.
I know. And I think the biggest questions are, why is there no real political will to put an end to it? But more importantly, what options would serve people best, right?
Yes.
So as we slide into this conversation, it's possible, and by that I mean it's more than likely, that we'll meander off into a few tangents here and there. Inevitably, there's a lot to uncover, sift through, digest, and debate about as we tip over Pandora's box, or is it Pandora's jar, vessel, vase? I don't know. That probably would be more accurate. Anyway, but hey, that's the kind of point here I'm trying to make here at QC, showing how everything is interconnected and interwoven, and how one conversation leads into another.
Yes, indeed.
So, on that note, we hope you'll stick around as we dive in. Okay, sleep. So let's talk about it. Paul, how did you sleep last night?
Not too badly. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Better than most nights.
Yeah. That's good. That's good. Mm-hmm.
And you?
Oh, thank you for asking. It took me. It always takes me a bit of time to sort of really get into that state where I'm falling asleep. But I thought, don't laugh, I was watching this very meditative sort of designs in the sand. This guy does this amazing, like, it's kind of Zen, sort of based on Zen gardening, but he does this on a table, and he's got this huge sort of like frame of sand, and he does these beautiful, really intricate geometric patterns.
Wow, that sounds beautiful.
So you just watch, and very artistic, so you just watch him do this, and then every once in a while there's like a slight gong, and I don't know, this must have lulled me to sleep. The things I do.
That sounds pretty good. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, so,
I might have to check that out.
I will have to send it to you. Yeah. So I did. When I eventually did fall asleep, it was good.
Excellent.
So, as we touched upon in our previous episode, sleep, or lack thereof, is so pervasive that we can find countless articles, clinical studies, and experts on the matter. And we know of the many factors that impact our ability to sleep well, and some of the measures we can take to mitigate poor nightly sleeps. But there might be other things we need. For example, why some of us might find sleeping a full, uninterrupted 8 hours every night a challenge. Call yourself lucky if you happen to be one of those people who don't. And that leads me to this first topic. So once upon a time, Or rather, at numerous points in time, people didn't do this whole 8 hours straight business. Yeah, and we sort of touched on that in the last episode. So I really wanted to take a look at Dr. Ekrich's findings, as well as other accounts about this whole biphasic sleep. So, as we say, gather around the campfire, children. But before I kind of go into that, I wanted to do a quick sort of disclaimer about biphasic sleep and the fact that we're going to be talking about it and its, you know, potential benefits doesn't mean that we're sort of describing this as a cure-all. And it's not necessarily a feasible option for many people who have sort of strict working hours or have other health conditions to contend with. But, you know, I thought it was a worth knowing about and exploring.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Especially, you know, as it retains to something really big in our history. And, you know, and I think it gives us a pause for our own sleeping patterns and habits and consider, is there something about biphasic sleep that resonates that we could incorporate? And, you know, if we are the type of person who frequently wakes up, you know, mid-sleep, maybe this is a remnant of an ancestral habit that's still embedded in us. Yeah.
Yes, actually, when you had brought it up to me before, you know, I learned a bit more about it. It definitely gave me a bit less anxiety and stress, you know, say when I woke up after 3 or 4 hours of sleep, you know, that sort of get into panic and frustration. But it's like, okay, you know, maybe this isn't so abnormal. Maybe it's going to be okay.
Maybe it's going to, yeah, I'm really pleased to hear that. That's really nice because, oh, my pleasure. I think if a lot of people knew that maybe this is a kind of a blueprint, an old blueprint left over, that maybe, like you said, there's not something that you're like, oh, it's not, maybe it's not me. Maybe there's not something wrong with me. Maybe this is just a hangover from my ancestral past.
This is true.
I think also, you know, when we're looking at sleep from a historical context and considering its potential benefits, this isn't to say that people in the past slept with no problems. Obviously, there are a whole host of things that one has to put into context, from people not having had a bed to sleep in, which was common, and, you know, finding sleeping wherever they could, to communal sleeping. And this was particularly noted from the Middle Ages onwards, and you would have entire families, and sometimes including like servants, in a single bed or taking turns in a bed.
Okay.
Yeah. So stuff that nowadays we'd be like, yeah. No.
Yeah. It's like, that's my pile of hay in the corner. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Need to get off of it.
Exactly. And then, you know, to dealing with also like a whole host of unsavory bed pests and other, you know, unsanitary situations, to sleeping aids, which in antiquity range, and even not so antiquity, even in the sort of more recent past, they kind of range from totally sound to totally insane.
Right. Okay.
I'm just going to put a quick case in point so that we don't veer off too much of a tangent, but I read somewhere of like weird ancient remedies, but one of them included like taking a sheep's liver and putting it between your ears as you go to bed as a remedy for insomnia. Yeah.
That's you just not going to help me sleep, I don't think.
I want to know the genius who thought this was a good idea. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So the next thing I think that's worth doing is figuring, sort of just briefly providing context about what is biphasic sleep. And biphasic is also known as bimodal sleep. And this very often when we're looking at bimodal sleep, we're looking at this sort of in terms of longer nighttime sleep, divided into two segments, but it could also be a long nighttime sleep and then a shorter nap, which could occur at some point in the afternoon.
Okay, right.
So this is essentially the term for biphasic sleep, and it was historically common. And in some settings, people find that it increases productivity and adaptability.
Okay.
And it's also worth noting that biphasic sleep and even polyphasic sleep is actually quite natural for many animals, including birds and insects. So it's not just us humans. But okay. think about the feline
yes.
world. Not just your domestic cats, but you know, your lions and tigers. Oh my, they're known for sleeping a lot throughout the day, and even at night when they often hunt.
Yeah, need a little rest before the prowl.
Exactly. Right. So, more recent sort of scientific evidence of biphasic or polyphasic sleep can be found in an often cited study, and this goes back to 1992 by a Thomas Ware, and it was originally published in the Journal of Sleep Research. So what Thomas Ware did was essentially he took sort of normal individuals who were used to having sort of 16 hours of photoperiod. Photoperiod is basically just your body's reaction to the length of light and dark, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the natural reaction. So they went from a conventional photoperiod, so 8 hours light, 8 hours dark, to an experimental 10-hour photoperiod.
Okay.
And in this study, he found that people's sleep expanded, and then it was divided into two symmetrical bouts with a sort of 1 to 3 hour waking interval between them.
Okay.
Yeah, the conclusion was basically shown that human sleep can be unconsolidated and polyphasic, just like that of animals.
Okay.
So this is sort of the sciencey aspect of things. So Roger Eckrich of the Virginia Polytechnic Institute, and he's a historian and professor, and he's basically credited with having made this discovery or rediscovering something about our ancestral past. So the story goes, in the early 1990s, Roger Eckrich walks into the Public Record Office in London, which at that point housed the UK National Archives from 1838 to 2003. And he was doing research on the history of nighttime activity, which subsequently became his sort of best-selling book. More about that in a moment. So whilst he's sifting through row after row of archives buried within other filed documents, he finds this sort of legal deposition, which was written in 1697 on vellum. And it's a testimony of a 9-year-old girl named Jane Roth, who had tragically lost her mother in an unresolved murder case. And in it, young Jane states that sometime around 11 p.m., she and her mother had woken up from their first sleep. So obviously what jumps out at was this expression, which he had never heard of before. And in it, he says, quote, "It was expressed in such a way that it seemed perfectly normal." So to be fair, until recently, I never heard of the expression first sleep. What about you?
No, I did not either. Just sleep.
Just sleep, exactly.
Yeah. So,
you know, this finding leads Eckrich to think that if Jane is referring to a first sleep, then that would indicate that there is indeed a second sleep.
Second or possibly third?
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. Who knows? So I don't want to go into the story of, because it's when I was like, oh, it's an unresolved murder mystery. It's like a cold case from 1697. You know, there are some interesting little details. It says that Jane talks about the fact that after their first sleep, her mother got up, went over to the fireside, began smoking a pipe, as you do, when two men appeared by the window, and they called out to her, instructed her to get ready with them. She knew them. And told her daughter to stay home and that she would be back later. And then sadly, of course, the mother never came back. As mentioned, this was a murder case. It was never resolved. So it's a tragic story. But even though the fascination here is about the first sleep, I actually, when I read this, I was like, so what happened to Jane? What happened to this poor girl? Like, did she have a father? He just seems absent from the story.
Right. Yeah.
But obviously Eckrich needed proof that the information that he had just sort of come across wasn't just a one-off. So he begins to do a lot more research and finding numerous resources and references. So I'm just trying to imagine being him and coming to the stumbling upon this, like how one little line alters everything suddenly for a person.
Sure. Yeah. And it's also interesting that you coming across that he's the first one who really thought to look into it, or that we know of.
Yeah.
To look into it and document it and look further.
Documenting. Yeah. It just didn't seem like something that it crossed people's radars. Maybe not in, you know, not in the same way that it had his. So interestingly enough, first sleeps are mentioned in Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tale. So this is obviously one of the most famous works of medieval literature in the West. Mm-hmm. And it's also in a 1561 satirical publication by the poet William Baldwin. And the publication is titled Beware the Cat, which some have deemed as the first English novel. Then it can be found also in a ballad titled Old Robin of Portingale. And this ballad can be found in something known as the Percy Folio, which stem from the 12th through the 17th century. And I'm going to read you just this little line. It says, "And at the awakening of your first sleep, you shall have a hot drink made. And at the awakening of your next sleep, your sorrows will have a slake." So first of all, there's that first sleep indicated in that line, and then the right. next sleep. And so that immediately stands up. Also the word slake, which I had never heard of before, and I was trying to figure out what that meant. So this means quenching of one's thirst.
Okay.
By the way, I went and I confirmed that this ballad actually does exist. The English spelling will have you laughing, because you're like, basically just however it sounded, and it could sound different things in different ways and different lines. So also you can find this in the Miguel Cervantes Don Quixote from 1615. And in it, there's a line that says, "Don Quixote followed nature, and being satisfied with his first sleep, did not solicit more. As for Sancho, he never wanted a second, for the first lasted him from night to morning." So it's kind of interesting because there's a lot being revealed here.
Right. Yes.
So, you know, all these sort of different findings resulted in Eckrich's 2006 book, A Day's Close, Night in Times Past. And in this, he unearthed at least 500 references to biphasic sleep.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. He said, "There is value in knowing about this prior pattern of sleep in the Western world. He's convinced that a large number of people who today suffer from middle-of-the-night insomnia, the primary sleep disorder in the United States, and I dare say in most industrialized countries, rather than experiencing a quote-unquote disorder, are in fact experiencing a very powerful remnant or echo of this earlier pattern of sleep." And it's, of course, worth noting that, you know, he was speaking from a historical perspective, not as a medical doctor. That's right. Eckrich's disclaimer, right? So, good to note. But I mean, I think it is worth highlighting, right? Mm-hmm. And it's also worth pointing out that, you know, Eckrich also points out that segmented sleep was common across pre-industrial Europe throughout the year, not just during the long winter nights. So whether it was in Northern Europe or Southern Europe, you know, taking into account sort of for more pronounced seasonal changes in Central and Northern Europe. But, you know, even in the siesta cultures of Spain and Italy, and I would say Portugal and Southern France, you know, where there are more moderate seasonal variations, there's still historical evidence of first and second sleep. So It wasn't just in England, if we referenced Cervantes before, obviously that's Spain. So, you know, there you go. And as in many pre-industrial cultures, sleep onset really kind of depended on what you had to do rather than sort of a fixed timetable like we have more nowadays. You know, nowadays we're used to having a more regimented timetable of our life.
Right, Right. They were not punching the clock, so to speak.
They were not. They were, yeah, no. And then there were periods where you had loads to do and periods where you had really not much to do. So you were able to sort of really enjoy sort of being, quote unquote, what we would now refer to as lazy.
Right. Or comfortable.
Or comfortable, exactly. So Eckrich also asserts that this whole thing is not just a peculiarity of the Middle Ages, as he states, but that it's been a dominant way of sleeping for millennia, and that's something we most likely inherited from, you know, our prehistoric ancestors. And we talked about that a little bit last time as well, how this might have evolved from, you know, being sort of hunter-gatherers and then settled agrarians and then having to deal with all kinds of potential disruptions at night, whether invading tribes or predatory animals or just keeping the fire going, that this biphasic sleep may have stemmed from that.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that said, of course, Eckrich has his critics, and they cite to other historical evidence and anthropological accounts of people's tendency to sleep sort of more uninterrupted hours at night. And I don't think these two things necessarily have to be separate matters. Like, the two things could have coexisted.
Mm-hmm.
Uninterrupted hours of sleep as well as sort of bimodal sleep could have been things that have contemporarily existed, or there might have just been periods within history and areas, geographic areas, where, or amongst people, where this one was more practiced than the other.
Right, right. I imagine even the seasons of the year could have had to do something to do with it. Yeah,
it could. Although Eckrich seems to indicate that wasn't necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. Although obviously in winter, you know, you have more pronounced night period. So it might indicate that you have longer sleep, and then as a result, you wake up and have more activity going on sort of in the middle of the night. Yeah. So one of the criticisms, though, that Eckrich replies to directly is in a paper that he published in 2016 by the Sleep Research Society called Segmented Sleep in Pre-Industrial Society. So in this, Eckrich is referring to a 2015 publication, November 2015 publication, which stated that there were three members of equatorial societies. So these are native tribal people from Tanzania, Namibia, and Bolivia, who did not, quote, regularly awaken for extended periods in the middle of the night. And so Eckrich, having, you know, written on the predominance of segmented sleep in pre-industrial Europe, was kind of intrigued by the studies, but he disagrees with the authors' conclusion, which is that biphasic sleep was probably not present before humans migrated into Western Europe and was most likely due to, as you had kind of alluded to, longer winter nights in the higher altitudes. So he's contesting that. And then he's contesting that in this 2016 paper, and says that, you know, not only is this broad inference highly questionable, but its significant historical and ethnographic evidence suggests that biphasic sleep was not unique to Western households, occurring in other cultures, including Middle East, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia, and Latin America, including in pre-industrial equatorial cultures, and thereby heightening the likelihood that throughout the pre-industrial world, that this form of sleep was not at all uncommon. That's what he's basically sort of stating. And then he cites, you know, a French priest and explorer and cosmographer, André Thévet, who, when traveling to Rio de Janeiro in 1555, reported that the Tubinaba Indians ate whenever they had an appetite, and even at night after their first sleep, they get up to eat and then they return to sleep. And then he goes to a source which documents that in the early 19th century, residents of Muscat in the capital of Oman were said to retire early, lying down before 10 o'clock, so that before midnight, their first sleep was usually over. Then, you know, further down, ethnographic evidence of numerous non-Western cultures from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century who were not exposed to artificial light still experienced first and second sleep, including several tribal people of Western and central parts of Africa. So there was an Australian anthropologist named George B. Silberbauer, who makes references to the Gwi people of Southern Africa, who are very similar to those that were published in the other study. So this other group of people called Gwi, who are very similar, apparently, according to this Australian anthropologist, they never had an uninterrupted night's sleep. And similarly, there are other anthropological evidence from the Tief people in central Nigeria, the Sinhalese people, who are an ethno-native group from Sri Lanka, and the Wulwa people in Central America, who all seem to practice sort of bimodal or polyphasic or biphasic sleep, and indeed have expressions in their own language pertaining to first and second sleep.
Interesting.
So we can see that this isn't just a peculiarity, as Eckrich points out, of the Middle Ages, and it's not just strictly European.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Spread far and wide. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he acknowledges in this paper, you know, he acknowledges that his own studies aren't asserting that biphasic sleep was the only or predominant pattern of sleep in all pre-industrial peoples, both in the Western and non-Western world. However, you know, these extensive examples are there to sort of counter that 2015 publication and highlight that they've named three groups of people, whereas he's got like numbers of different groups and different peoples throughout different eras.
He brought receipts, as the kids like to say.
Exactly. And speaking of which, by the time he had published his book, he'd found over 2,000 references in a dozen languages, going as far back as ancient Greece, supposedly, to demonstrate biphasic sleep. So, you know, this is quite a sizable amount of information. I'm going to try and wrap it up, because I want to let you also sort of share your research as well and your findings. But it's also worth noting that one of the big changes that we are seeing here is, why did biphasic sleep disappear, right? And the short answer is light, lots of light. So by 1807, we have this introduction of gas street lights in London. And only 16 years later, there are at least 40,000 lamps lit throughout the entire city. Throughout the entire city streets, particularly. And by 1860, it was said that there were more than 300 municipalities across the U.S. that had gas street lamps. So these advances in illumination would have shown up, obviously, in businesses and affluent neighborhoods. And we can imagine that these changes, although they're seemingly tame by today's standards, would really have created sort of the first shakeup in people's habits, but also in terms of our, you know, in terms of their physiological reactions. So light from a lone gas mantle proved 12 times as strong as that from a candle or oil lamp, which is what people were using, right, predominantly for the longest time. Whereas light from a single electric bulb by the close of the 19th century was 100 times more in strength.
Wow. Interesting. Right? Yeah.
So the belief is that this major transformation in lighting resulted in later urban bedtimes, although initially it apparently brought no evident change in rising times, which was usually at dawn. And as a result of these sort of later hours, people felt more fatigued than their predecessors had when they went to bed. So you can imagine that if we go from, you know, the oil lamp and a candle, then to gas lamps, and then suddenly to artificial illumination, which then quickly also became pervasive throughout most towns and cities in the Western Hemisphere, that this would completely upend our way of correlating to our nighttime habits.
Sure, it's life-changing.
Yeah, and if the drive to sleep is increased, then it makes sense that people began to sleep for longer durations at night as kind of a way of recuperating what they had previously lost in terms of that pattern of two sleeps. So, you know, this way you had sort of a larger propensity to sleep in an uninterrupted state because your body's just trying to make up for what it had previously lost.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. It's also interesting to note that a renowned sleep and circadian researcher by the name of Dr. Charles, and I hope I'm not butchering his surname, Seisler, remarked that every time we turn on a light, we are inadvertently taking a drug that affects how we sleep.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So sleep propensity is sort of extremely sensitive to artificial light in particular. So just a few hours of exposure to it via the photoreceptors in the retinas of our eyes can completely reset our circadian pacemaker. They're referred to as a circadian pacemaker, which is effectively like this tiny body of cells, supposedly the size of a rice grain. And that controls the flow of hormones and changes in body functions. And of course, these changes or fluctuations include things like your melatonin levels.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is produced in the pineal gland, which is in turn central to the sleep-wake cycle, right? So you have serotonin during the day and then melatonin produced at night, right? Mm-hmm. So the arrival of darkness is supposed to sort of signal our pineal gland to produce the melatonin, which helps to induce sleep. But of course, if we're exposed to artificial light, our melatonin gets suppressed.
So, yes.
Yeah.
No bueno.
No bueno. Exactly. And so similarly, mm-hmm. Seisler kind of notes that this circadian pacemaker expects darkness, right? It getting exposed to light, and it just, it's basically what it's telling the brain is like, okay, clearly it's not dark, so we have to reset. So it's constantly trying to reset itself, and that suppresses the melatonin.
Wow. So this was obviously a start of a big shift in society.
This was a huge shift of society, and you know, it's connected to light. It's connected to obviously the industrial era, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're seeing the shift in our sleep really being catapulted by all of these changes in society. And it's worth noting that, you know, 8 hours in a row is a construct in a way,
mm-hmm.
right? So many of these changes, I think, that we're looking at weren't necessarily holistic in approach. They just kind of happened because these changes arrived sort of forcefully and often abruptly during both the first and the second industrial era. So we have to contend with machinery, large-scale production. You know, textile was the first thing that became this large-scale production. Shift work, which particularly even in the late 1800s was diabolical, really grueling. People very literally worked themselves to death.
Right.
And in some cases, you know, having 17-hour, 18-hour work shifts, sometimes just to keep up with what was expected of them. You have the expansion of railways and trade and travel and technology. So all of these things, and referring to technology, obviously artificial light, but also the telegraph and the telephone. And then you have the standardization of time. And all of this happened within, you know, if we're looking at it from a historical context, really within a short span of time.
Sure. Yeah.
In
the grand scheme of things, you know, this must have been really disruptive.
Yeah.
For people's lives, whereas, you know, we've always grown up, it's healthy to get 8 hours of sleep a night.
And in theory, it's not wrong, but it doesn't necessarily work.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, whereas, you know, these people may have started before this period, and what a shift in their lives, you know.
Yeah, and you know, it's really more recently that we've kind of begun to even seriously consider in detail through studies and through sort of understanding the history, the negative impact and consequences that all these changes had, particularly, let's say, from the mid-1800s to now on our well-being. Because, again, you know, the first industrial revolution, you know, depending on where you were, happened sometime around the 1760s. Mm-hmm. And then we're ending the second industrial revolution or era just right around the First World War.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you're looking at all the things that were happening just in terms of industry and in terms of technology and in terms of sort of invention and changes in like our literal infrastructures in society, that's a lot to happen in a short span of time.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, with that came sort of shifting habits and attitudes to how people slept. So in order to sort of reinforce that, these new constructs, be it sleep, work hours, etc., it means that you kind of have to, and for this to be seen sort of as something sort of rational, logically, morally, ethically sound, you kind of do it through, you know, propaganda, for lack of a better word. So you create a new ideology, and this meant and included phrases that we are actually really familiar with today, which were things like the ideal worker, or the Anglo-Saxon work ethic, or, you know, the successful businessman, a prosperous society, a powerful nation. All of these things were linked to productivity.
Right.
So obviously then, you know, the whole idea of biphasic sleep would have been sort of antithetical to that.
Of course. Yeah.
So, yeah. So in essence, this is really what made us forget completely about biphasic sleep.
Sure, until it just became the norm.
Right.
You know, then this was pushed as the new norm, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Again, this is a really sort of annotated or shortened version of it. And there's also another book recommendation that I would include, which is a book by Benjamin Reese, and it's called Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. And this also sort of goes over why we are dealing with the consequences of our sleeplessness nowadays. Like we're managing everything. We're trying to manage time, and we're trying to manage sleep.
Right.
And as a result, we are none the wiser and sleeping none the better.
Right, right. Yeah, maybe not doing either very well.
Not doing either very well, yeah. So that is it on my end. But I do think that's a good springboard to yours, because we are talking about sort of these revolutionary changes and standardizations of time. So with that, I'm going to pass the baton over to you, Paul. And I know you're going to introduce and talk a little bit about daylight saving time, that and the dreaded habit of the annual changing our clocks twice a year. And this does kind of correlate to what we were just talking about, you know, the industrial era, particularly the second industrial revolution. Sure. So yeah, why not tell us a little bit more about this dreaded practice.
Yes, so daylight saving time was originally used to save energy and make better use of daylight at the end of the day while sacrificing an hour of light in the morning. It was first used in 1908 in Thunder Bay and Port Arthur, Ontario. Became widely used during World War I. Germany and Austria introduced daylight savings time in 1916, and that was, you know, thought to have saved energy and fuel during the war. Of course, England, France, and many other countries followed suit soon after. Daylight saving time is thought to have been invented by New Zealand scientist George Vernon Hudson and British builder William Willett. In 1895, Hudson presented a paper to the Wellington Philosophical Society in New Zealand, proposing a two-hour shift forward in October and a two-hour shift back in March.
That's even worse than the one-hour forth, yeah, back and forth.
Yes. You know, I read a couple of different articles, but also there was someone who made a video about, they didn't call him a scientist. They called him a postal worker who liked to collect butterflies in the evening. So I guess maybe he's a scientist, I guess, in the evening. So he would have appreciated that extra time for butterfly collection.
Yeah, I guess that's probably what it was all about.
Right. It all came down to that. Thanks. So, as I was saying, he proposed a two-hour shift forward and a two-hour shift back. There was some interest in the idea, but it was never really followed through with. And then independently in 1905, British builder William Willett suggested setting the clocks ahead 20 minutes on each of the four Sundays in April and then switching them back by the same amount on each of the four Sundays in September.
Oh my God.
A total of 8 time switches, as if 2 aren't bad enough.
What you see already, you know, you're like, this is I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt your flow, but this is absolutely astounding to me that you already have these men who are going, what if we just added some more hours, and you're going, for what reason? So that you can collect butterflies, that it's better for your schemes and your plans.
This is right. Looking further, it was also seemed to be more of an ancient idea as well. We've used it for approximately the last 100 years, on and off. Ancient civilizations were known to have engaged in similar practices. The Roman water clocks used different scales for different months of the year to adjust the daily schedule to solar time, which in theory is when the sun is highest at noon. Although,
yes,
you know, I'm not sure how exact that is, but yeah, so
it changes. I mean, if we're looking at ancient times, and you know, our earth tilt has you know, slightly changed, and
yes, this is true. So more widely, it was used, you know, during World War One. After the war, most places did away with daylight savings time, as it wasn't very popular because of, you know, what happens in winter. So yeah, so it was adopted again during World War II, and then again, mostly done away with afterwards in most places. So from 1945 to 1966 in the U.S., there was no federal law on daylight savings time. So localities could choose, you know, whether they wanted to keep it, drop out of it. New York, which was a financial center, kept daylight savings time going for a while, and others would follow that. But it was very inconsistent throughout. So by 1962, in the U.S., the transportation industry found the lack of consistency to be very confusing, and they pushed for federal regulation. The result was the Uniform Time Act of 1966, which was signed by President Lyndon Johnson in April of 1966. Yeah, so that law switched it to daylight savings time in the spring, and then falling back to regular standard time in the fall or winter time, as you mentioned earlier. So
right.
Yeah, so that sort of, you know, formalized it there. But in 1973, of course, there was the oil embargo by OPEC, and in an effort to conserve fuel, Congress enacted a trial period of around year-round daylight savings time. So that started in 1974 and ended in April of 1975. So it was a hotly debated topic. Those in favor are, of course, pointed to the increased daylight hours in the summer and evening, more time for recreation,
right,
reduced lighting and heating demands, reduced crime, reduced automobile accidents. So, and then of course, people were opposed to waking up, you know, going to work in the dark and the sun not rising till 9 a.m. in some parts, 8:30 a.m. in other parts. So it was still a, you know, hotly contested idea. President Nixon had signed it into law in 1974. Congress switched it back in 1975. So, yeah, so nowadays it is used in over 70 countries worldwide. It affects 1 billion people every year. And the beginning and end dates vary from one country to another, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I think when do you technically in the States change your clocks?
Yes, yeah, so we spring forward in March.
And yeah, around when in March?
I think this year it's March 10th.
Okay, because so in Europe, it's in most of Western Europe, it's the end of March.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. So,
just to make it even more exciting, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, and then I think in the first or second week of November, we fall back.
Yeah, and here it's end of October. So we're always, yeah, we're gypped even more, I think.
Right. So, yeah. So I actually found an article on CNN from, let's see, November of 2022. Let's see, it starts with a growing number of experts say that active moving our clocks forward in the spring is ruining our health. Studies over the last 25 years have shown the 1 hour change disrupts body rhythms tuned to the Earth's rotation, adding fuel to the debate over whether having daylight savings time in any form is a good idea. Dr. Elizabeth Klerman, she's a professor of neurology in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School. She says, quote, "I'm one of the many sleep experts that knows it's a bad idea. Your body clock stays with natural light, not with your clock on the wall," she says. "There's no evidence that your body fully shifts to the new time at all." So Dr. Phyllis Zee, she's a director of the Center for Circadian and Sleep Medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and she also opposes daylight savings time. She says between March and November, your body gets less morning light and more evening light, which can throw off your circadian rhythm. Standard time, which we enter when we move our clocks back in the fall, is much closer to the sun's night and day cycle, she says. This cycle has set our circadian rhythm, our body clocks, and our body clocks for centuries. So the internal timer control is not just when you controls not just when you sleep, but also when you want to eat, exercise, and work, as well as it affects your blood pressure, your heart rate, and your cortisol rhythms. A call to ban daylight saving time for good has come from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, who say, quote, current evidence best supports the adoption of year-round standard time, which aligns best with human circadian biology and provides distinct benefits for public health and safety. This proposal has been endorsed by more than 20 medical, scientific, and civic organizations, including the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, the National Parent Teacher Association, the National Safety Council, the Society for Research on Biological Rhythms, and the World Sleep Society.
So can I ask you something? If you get all of these expertise saying this and calling for it, how come nothing has been done?
Right. Well, so I was going to go towards the other side of the argument here.
But, all right.
Yes. So in March of 2021, the United States Senate passed the Sunshine Protection Act. So, of course, it's not a law yet because it would have to go through the House of Representatives and then to the executive branch, which it hasn't done either.
Right.
So they want daylight savings to become permanent. They unanimously passed this, and they say that the extra daylight in the evening cuts down on car accidents and crime, increases the opportunities for commerce and recreation, as people prefer to shop and exercise during the daylight hours.
I just caught that little end bit. It's more money to be spent.
Yeah, it's always money. So I looked into, you know, sort of which industries were sort of backing this, lobbying for this, and the big one seems to be the golfing industry, which is, you know, interesting.
That's so random, Paul.
Right.
The golfing industry has such leverage.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because I know some serious, I'm not a golfer or very into golfing myself, but I know some serious golfers who wake up at the crack of dawn and they get out there and they go. But I imagine if you're trying to get new people into the sport, maybe, you know, the evening hours, you know, are more conducive for that. So another one that may seem kind of random, especially to our European friends, is the barbecue industry. Uh-huh. The makers of barbecue grills.
People in Europe barbecue. They barbecue.
Oh, of course they do. You know, in the U.S., it's, you know.
Yes, it's a cult.
There you go. So yes. So also, many cities chambers of commerce back it, and you know they believe that extra hours for retail shopping in the evening would be beneficial for their businesses to make money. Yeah. So those are some of the arguments for, and I am for regular standard time. Now, I've lived in Southern California most of my life. For me, it's the first week when we fall back and it's getting dark before 5 p.m. That's a bit odd and people feel, you know, a bit depressed. I find that I sleep better during this time. I know in other parts of the world it's a much bigger shift, and you know, sort of getting dark by 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. in Northern Europe.
Well, particularly sort of in the Nordic countries, I think that's more pronounced. Mm-hmm. You know, in winter, at the peak of the winter solstice period, you're gonna have polar nights where really, you know, by 2:30 the sun, you know, that's 2:30 in the afternoon, you're going to have the sun beginning to set already, you know, and that can really impact people. It's interesting.
Yes. I watch a channel on YouTube, the lady's name is Cecilia. Cecilia Blumenthal, forgive me, some of you may know her, but she and her partner and their dog, and they're in the midst of 2 months of polar nights.
Yeah, that's intense. You know, you have to, and you really need to find things to keep your morale and your spirit up. And that's why people have in those places, you know, higher levels of depression, even if it's just seasonal depression, unfortunately also higher rates of suicide, things like that. It's really interesting, just a quick side note, in the UK, they tried between February of 1968 to November 71 to have like an experiment of just permanent daylight saving.
Okay.
And then ended up abandoning it. But the thing that I'm hearing from what you're telling me is that ultimately this insistence of us changing our clocks back and forth twice a year is really like something that became quote unquote permanent, let's say around the mid 70s, early to mid 70s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's a complete artifice and it's not serving us. So why don't we get rid of it?
Yes, yes. The going back and forth. I mean, let's choose a time, in my opinion. There is also, so to fight back the other side of the Sunshine Protection Act, researchers have talked about, especially in the spring forward, where you lose mm-hmm. the hour, mm-hmm. You get extra daylight, but you lose the hour. Research has shown that heart attacks and fatal car accidents increase. Also, children end up going to school in the morning while it's still dark. And actually, in 1974, there were 8 school children killed in the dark mornings. Yeah, so Florida's governor put forth a law to repeal that. Mm-hmm. And also, by 1975, the public realized that it wasn't such a good idea to have daylight savings permanently.
Yeah. But this is the thing is, though, Paul, like when you're heading into spring, the dark hours, I mean, you're going to get them in winter too. Like you have darkness in winter. I mean, like when, most people are working and again, I'm talking for people who experience, more seasons and more pronounced seasons. You begin October, November, especially is like really bleak and you wake up, it's dark. Mm-hmm. It's bloody dark. You go to work and then maybe you'll see a little bit of light and then you leave work and guess what? It's dark again.
Right.
So this is the problem, and I think it's also worth noting that by the time, you're heading into February and March, the days are getting longer. And it does start getting earlier. It starts getting lighter earlier. I mean, and in summer, like if you're in Europe in summer, you will start hear birds chirping at like 4:45 in the morning. You're like, shut up. And I love the birds chirping, but they get really active. They're like.
For sure. Yeah. No. And it's interesting to note as well that, we're springing forward and getting this extra hour of light when the days do naturally start to
get longer
daylight.
Yeah. So that's why it's nonsensical. Yeah. It's nonsensical in that regard. I agree. My question is, we have all this evidence. They've tried various mm-hmm. things. It's not worked. So is it A, just a lack of political will? Is it B, the fact that there are particular industries and powerful lobbies that mm-hmm. want to insist on things going one way rather than another? And C, where are the people in this? Like, where's the feedback from people? Because mm-hmm. I know there was a recent poll, again, I'm citing to the UK, but I know there was a government polling done. And I think this was just a couple of years ago, where overwhelmingly people in Great Britain wanted to have daylight saving. But of course, it's possible that they didn't have all of the information in front of them. Go on to permanent daylight saving. And it's possible that, they were thinking about having sort of a little bit more sunlight hours, especially sort of as you head into autumn, available to them after work, which I understand, which I definitely understand. I don't know. I mean, I'm just going to throw it first at you. What do you think a solution to this would be? I mean, I know you're in Southern California, so you may not feel these pronounced differences quite in the same way.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm for standard time. So mm-hmm. I just think it's the disruption of springing forward and falling back is the issue. Like, it needs to be one thing. The Senate, they passed this law for permanent daylight savings time, which in the summer sounds nice, but as we see in the winter,
but then
it's not so nice.
But maybe the issue is, and I think that's what I'm trying to get at. Maybe the issue isn't at the in the United States, for example, maybe the issue shouldn't be at the federal level, but at the state level, because certainly I think, I know Arizona
Arizona and Hawaii.
And I think Alaska was considering not changing their times either, or maybe, I don't know. But at least these two states have made this decision. I don't know why states don't just put this on the ballot rather than trying to insist that the federal government, this gets passed in the federal government, because if you know anything about, you know, politics nowadays, and particularly in the United States, you know that's never going to get resolved. It's the same. It's the same Europe within Europe. You know, in 2019 or 2018, that European parliamentary members decided to end this whole changing our clocks back and forth twice a year, and they said, okay, we're going to permanently end it. However, we cannot come to an agreement about how to end it. Right.
Sure.
And the issue that I have here is that you've got experts, and this is, again, particularly true within Europe, you've got experts who are not really reaching out to people. So shouldn't it be a question of nations who are sovereign informing people and saying, here are three, here are two or potentially three options. I will let you know about my third options in just a second. But here are two potential options. Here are the pros and cons of each.
Right.
Considering these, we're going to put it to a vote, and the based on the majority, and looking at, you know, expertise, we'll make a decision. We'll make a decision for our country.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, my third option, by the way, not that anyone asked, but
what's your third option?
Third option is do a half an hour. So, in other words, if it's an hour forward, an hour back. Right. What if you just switched it to a half hour, and this way both sides are happy?
Okay. So I'm trying to get my head wrapped around how.
So rather than springing forward an hour, you just spring forward a half hour.
Right.
And you just leave it at that. So that's a halfway.
And then you go never back again and fall.
No switching. You just change it to, like, you just have a half hour time shift, and then you just leave it at that indefinitely. So it's neither daylight saving, it's neither standard time, it's somewhere sort of in the middle. It's sort of a compromise. I don't know. I'm not the only one who's proposed this.
Okay.
But it would make sense in areas, as particularly in countries where there's a lot more division around it. I also think, again, you know, if you're closer to the equator, the closer you are to the equator, the less you're going to feel these extremes. So remaining on standard time makes sense. Maybe in certain other countries, they may want to adopt something differently. But I do think if you are going to abolish the whole changing your clocks back and forth twice a year, that you provide citizens' input, and that they are part of the decision-making process.
Right.
Rather than having lobbyists, businesses, governments bicker, you know, government entities and different parts of the political aisle bickering amongst each other, and then choosing to never resolve it because they threw in the monkey wrench to begin with. They threw that monkey wrench into the thing to begin with, and now they're not willing to, you know, resolve it.
Go. No, I think your idea is a good one in the sense that it wouldn't be such a drastic change.
Yeah.
Which that there's a lot of validity to that, health wise, especially. So yeah, I think.
And if you think it's weird.
No, I was just going to say, you know, leaving it up to local areas, you know, because like you say, everywhere is different. Yeah. And let's see what makes sense. And yes, power to the people. Let them
power
vote.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, I think this is the thing, and I do feel like this is part of a bigger conversation, but we leave too much up to, I love this expression, our selected officials.
Right.
Your selected officials to resolve things that they will never, ever be bothered to resolve. You know, because kicking the can down the proverbial lane is par for the course in the politics, and it's not a concern for them. And everyone complains, and every year we have to do it anyway. But if this is something we truly want to change, then we shouldn't be asking, we should be demanding. We should be demanding. There have been petitions, but these should be much more impactful. They should be much more aggressive. And they should say, we need to be able to get the input of citizens, and there should be campaigns for each country to figure out what best suits their country, what best suits their lifestyles, and what they would want in terms of, because if it's all a construct, then they should be able to choose which one suits them best.
Yeah, very good points there. You know, I think the another thing I would say that with all of the problems going on in the world, this may be further down the ladder,
well, yeah,
you know.
But isn't it always convenient that issues that could be resolved always get ignored?
And I think
yes, you're right. I mean, there are loads of problems, but it's the same way that nobody seems to be bothering to deal with the massive problems that we have throughout the West, whether it's in the States or in the UK or the rest of Europe, with problems with infrastructure, with public transportation, with housing, predominantly affordable housing, with inflation, with wages. All those things are never addressed. And yet, if you ask any politician, they seem to have endless funds for wars.
Yes.
And that's taxpayers' money.
Right.
And once again, your selected officials.
There you go. Don't worry, there'll be many more episodes on some of these topics.
There will. I could go on, but I'm not going to. Anything right. else, Paul? Sorry, before I...
No. I just had one last quote from Dr. Thurman. And she says that the United States has tried permanent daylight savings twice before and ended it early. The UK tried once before and ended it early. Russia tried it once. So did India. They all ended early. I think we should learn from our history.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. We should get rid of the whole thing altogether. Just saying, people, just bear in mind my half hour suggestion, because I think there's something there.
Yes. It's a good idea to put out there for sure, so people can talk about it and think about it themselves. Right?
That's the whole point. Indeed. Mm. All right. Thank you, Paul.
You're welcome.
So, one thing which strikes me about the topics we've covered in this episode is that at first glance, they may seem unrelated, but there is a correlation, and namely the Industrial Revolution. Because by the time the first Industrial Revolution began, the habits of two sleeps, at least in the Western world, would have largely faded due to the sudden and dramatic socioeconomic and political changes in society. So it's here where we see major transitions in labor, machinery, production, specifically the first glimpses of large-scale textile production and trade. And then shortly after, there's the advent of the steam trains, and then the all-out railway expansion. And this being the mother of all changes as we know it, especially as it relates to time. It's taken the likes of Professor Eckrich to rediscover the peculiarity of this ancestral sleep. And this seems to have come at a key point in our current history, when the lack of sleep and sleeping disorders have become truly endemic. It's prompted us to consider the possible benefits of biphasic sleep, and if nothing else, it helps us sort of dispel this belief that throughout time we've slept in the same manner at night, namely 7 to 8 hours straight. And it gives us pause to think about other ways that we can rest and recuperate, be it incorporating daily naps, meditating, and or sort of creating an environment which optimizes and invites us to sleep better at night. Just as much as we are looking to our past about the many benefits of slowing down and resting, so too are we reconnecting to forgotten crafts, forgotten knowledge, and not to mention the natural world. In reclaiming the virtues of good rest and sleep, we can perhaps find ways of sleeping which resonate with us more innately, the way our ancestors might have, rather than what we've been systemically conditioned and conformed to do. Of course, there are many other aspects to consider, namely our work, economic and social structures, which don't necessarily complement or converge well with biphasic and polyphasic sleep. But let's leave that for another time. And speaking of which, it's worth noting that the Second Industrial Revolution, which began in the 1870s and ended around the First World War, brought with it a whole system of measurements and standardizations, particularly when it came to time. In 1884, the International Telegraph Union held the International Meridian Conference in Washington, D.C., and divided the world into 24 time zones. Within less than a decade, as Paul sort of mentioned, not alluded, Why do I always say alluded? You mentioned it, Paul.
Alluded's a good word.
Alluded, yes, because it is a good word. But within less than a decade, the first legislative proposal for DST came forth in New Zealand, of all places. Glad that that did not work. and clearly, when it comes to switching our clocks back and forth every year, it is high time to ditch this inane and frustrating practice. Whether we stay on standard time or spring forward an hour in March is still to be determined. And maybe individual countries should turn to their citizens for feedback and a decision as to which direction they would like to go. The thing is, times are changing and time itself seems to be changing. Our 24-day cycles aren't quite 24 hours. More recently, after being told the Earth's speed had been incrementally slowing down, apparently it's spinning even faster due to a newly discovered Chandler wobble. And don't even get me started on our Earth's magnetic polar shifts, or the impact that solar storms and solar flares and radiation has on our planet. No, I mean it, don't, because I'm trying to grasp these concepts, and needless to say, all of it impacts our sense of time.
And speaking of which, we're just about out of it for this episode.
Oh, yeah. Small mercies, Pi.
But why don't you tell the listeners what we have coming up next?
Yes, nice segue, my friend. Well, so yes, next time we might head deeper into this world of how we got standardized time and time zones. It is filled with intrigue and conspiracies and a lot of machinations.
Really?
Well, yeah, kind of.
Are you just trying to sex up something rather nerdy?
That's how I roll. That's how I roll, people. But I do want to, you know, cover some really fascinating stuff that you won't want to miss.
Well, on that note, thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Indeed, thank you. And as always, keep those gray cells churning, the conversation going, and Godspeed.